more fishing effort on these fish to maintain this level of catch. Harvest levels on coho, as determined by tagging studies, appear to be excessively high. Now, we haven't done these studies region-wide, and most of the tagging work that has been done has been done on systems that drain into Lynn Canal and the Stevens Passage area near Juneau. Harvests in the range of 70 to 90% of the total run have been documented for some systems. These rates are considered dangerously high, and this would be especially true on years of poor return. You might get away with that type of harvest rate if you have a really large return. Escapement levels in systems where we can measure them, and there's not too many places in the region where we can actually monitor coho escapement levels, and of course there's over 2,000 anadromous fish streams in the region. Now, the escapements appear minimal in recent years, and some of these escapement figures that we've gotten have been in conjunction with the tagging work. In recent years, not every year, but on some years, inside water fisheries, this is sport fisheries, troll fisheries, and net fisheries, have received fewer coho than normal as a result of increased fishing effort along the outside coast and in the major entryways for coho salmon. Now, this was particularly true in 1979, this past season. Inside fisheries throughout the region took fewer than normal numbers of coho. Obviously, the cohos were not reaching these areas, and of course, this is why we're instituting in-season closures. However, the overall coho catch in the region was actually above normal, and most of these fish were intercepted before they ever reached the inside waters. Again, this is a reflection of the increased effort put forth by our user group, primarily the users in the troll fishery. These danger signs all indicate that we should not put more effort on our coho stocks. In fact, we probably should be looking at further ways to reduce effort.
Other than Jack, what about the hatcheries, which we've been investing in quite heavily? Isn't this going to reduce some of the stress on the cohos?
Hatchery production, of course, in southeastern Alaska has reached the point where it's making a major contribution to the troll fishery, or the coho fishery, I should say. At this point, these hatcheries are still in the build-up stage. Only a few facilities are receiving adult returns. Of course, these hatcheries fish should be viewed as supplemental fish. They shouldn't be viewed as replacement of natural stocks, which basically we're getting for a fairly low price, our natural production. We try to plan the placement of these facilities so that these fish will not overly interfere with our harvest of the natural stocks. Now, there is on the drawing board major numbers of coho salmon projected to come from hatcheries, but we're not receiving it yet. But basically, what we're harvesting up till this point is natural stocks.
Do your projections show a situation whereby within 3, 4, 5 years you're going to have these returns to where you're not going to endanger the species?
Again, the actual hatchery returns really, although there may be a benefit to all the user groups, they won't necessarily keep us from solve our problems of over putting too much pressure on the natural stocks. I don't know what our projections are within 5 years, maybe Steve has some idea.
I don't have that figure off the top of my head, Mr. Chairman. We don't have anyone here from the Fur Division tonight, but it's several hundred thousand. I don't think it's over 5 years. I think you're looking at a couple of cycles before you're talking about that type of magnitude. And again, this would be more fish that would be available to allocate to different individuals. We'd still have to, of course, protect the natural stocks because they're still producing a million fish a year, and you're going to have to manage to protect them while hopefully being able to manage to allow the harvest of these extra hatchery fish. Certainly, to alleviate part of the allocation question in terms of making more fish available to more people when they come online.
My concern, I don't want to belabor it because we've got a lot of people spending a lot of vested time, but we have young Alaskans who are very interested in being in the entry and fishing program, and from what I'm beginning to hear, there is no way to enter. I hope this isn't a 4, 5, or 6 year type situation.
Mr. Chairman, I think under limited entry, that's a common situation in many fisheries. And the resource is finite, and there are provisions, of course, through the buyback programs, which I'm sure people here from the limited entry can talk to you about. In case you wish to reduce the year, all provisions are presumably for expanding gear if your runs expand substantially. Now, on a consistent basis, our salmon runs generally in Alaska have been up the past couple of years. They were down in the early 70s. It's spotty this year. We've got one of the biggest runs in history forecast for Bristol Bay and western Alaska from Kodiak on around. The other areas from Cook on the Pennsylvania Sound and southeastern are marginal at best. We've talked ourselves about the copper river situation, so it's not a completely static thing all over the state. But if hatchery production comes on in a meaningful manner, then certainly that's going to have to be taken into consideration by the commission in terms of the number of hatcheries anticipated.
Go ahead, I don't want to get you sidetracked.
As I pointed out, all user groups have been increasing their pressure on the fish, and I forgot to mention this includes sport fishermen too. We're getting a larger sport fisher in the region. However, when you look at the statistics, it's quite clear that the major source of increased effort on our king and coho salmon stocks is within the troll fishery. Hand trollers have rapidly increased with numbers with no limited entry program on the fishery. The hand troll fleet has greatly increased in efficiency through the widespread conversion from the use of sport rods to the use of girded gear. Full-time hand trollers, usually fishing girded gear, have become more numerous, and more large vessels in the 30 to 40 foot class are being used in the fishery. In the handout that you've just been given, if you look at table 4, you can see listings of the numbers, increase in numbers of permits just since 1975. Of course, 1975 is the base year for any kind of division in statistics between the power troll and hand troll fishery. The catch statistics were kept together prior to that time. You can see on the top of the table there that the number of interim permits out jumped from 2017 and 75 up to 3696 this last year, which was down slightly from the peak in 1978. One interesting thing that I found in this table that I wasn't aware of is the increase and non-resident fishermen that are participating in the hand troll fishery. Apparently these are boats, I knew some of them were around, but I didn't realize the number of this large boats that are coming up from down below and participating in this fishery because it's open. Figure 2 the line graph.
Do you have any more of those? You can get
them. We passed them to the audience, so I forgot to share them because I didn't have enough for this type of crowd.
Two additional copies here.
On figure 2, you can see the major increase in the number of hand troll landings that have been made since 1975. Of course, in 1975, it shows below 10,000 hand troll landings in the region, and of course, it peaked up over 30,000 in 1978, and it dropped back again slightly in 1979. Hand troll catches of coho salmon have increased sharply since 1975, and this increase is best shown on the front table there in table 2. Down on the left-hand corner, it shows the total catch by year for inside and outside districts.
Mr. Chairman, could we back up just a little?
Sure.
The handout that I have on, it says table 4, salmon hand troll permits issued by CFEC. Was that the statistic you used just a few months ago about the increase in non-resident hand trolling permit?
Okay, one of the figures that I pointed out just for interest sake, really, in the middle of the page there on the top row of figures, it says non-resident permits. It shows that there were only 11 non-residents in the fishery in 1975. And of course, there was 379 in 1979, so it's an interesting trend. It shows that since this fishery is open that we're getting interest from down below. It doesn't really have any bearing on the stock consideration any more than the overall number increase of residents.
Well, that's the point that intrigued me, because when I look down 1979, it says 10.3 or percent are non-residents, right?
Right.
But when I drop on down the power troll, it says 22.9 of them are non-residents.
Yes, the power troll fleet certainly
okay.
Always had a percent of non-residents. It's been fairly stable.
Thank you very much.
Power trollers, although limited in numbers, also have been increasing their effort on king and coho salmon. New and larger boats, more capable of fishing extended trips offshore, have been built. Many of these new boats have freezing capability or the ability of holding ice for extended periods of time. The large new vessels have tended to fish more lines. Of course, now the board has recently passed a line restriction on power trawlers offshore too, but there were some vessels out there fishing as many as 10 and 12 lines. The use of crewmen or boat pullers has been increasing. More fishing effort is being shifted offshore each year by power trawlers. And you can see the magnitude of this shift, either in landings or in coho catch on tables 1 and 2. Looking at table 2, the coho catch, you can see that in 1975, only 30% of the coho catch by power trawlers was actually taking place on the outside of the outer coastal waters. Of course, in 1979, this is shifting to where 80% of the coho catch is being taken out there. This effort shift places more effort on our coho stocks earlier in the season and at greater distances from their home streams. So in other words, this effort shipped outside actually represents more effort on the fish. They're getting on the fish earlier and fishing over a longer time span and over a greater distance on their migration route. In both the hand troll and the power troll fishery, increased competition for fish, high fish prices, and the need to realize returns on large investments have encouraged more effort to be put forth by individual fishermen. Considering the condition of our king and coho salmon stocks, it is imperative that effort on these fish be stabilized and possibly reduced. The troll fishery harvests extremely mixed stocks of king and coho salmon, and we cannot manage it for individual stocks. This means that only broad regulatory measures, such as gear restrictions and large geographical closures, are effective in limiting effort. In other words, if we just shut down a small area, all we do is transfer the effort to an adjacent open area. We must check the increases in trolling effort on our king and coho stocks or risk a major decline in these resources. Our database is weak, and this, along with the complex nature of the troll fishery, dictates a conservative management approach. I believe most fishermen recognize the need for conservation. I've been working with them for years, and most of them understand the need for regulation and the need to get the fish in the creek. Now, the allocative aspect of any management scheme that is applied to a resource that is harvested by multiple user groups is usually the point that creates the most controversy. And of course, in the case of the coho salmon resource, where we have about five different user groups operating on it, this seems to be the major bone of contention. And I would only stress that we feel we're right up against the line on our coho resources. We don't feel we can take any more pressure. And of course, if we ever lost this resource, the economic effect in this region would be disastrous.
Is there any questions by members of the committee? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thank Mr. Beaton. Mm-hmm.
Senator Bennett, do you want me to follow up on it?
Yes, if you'd like to.
Can I bring my board lawyer here, Greg?
Sure. Whatever you feel comfortable with.
Everybody's got to have a lawyer now.
Please state your name. Who you represent?
My name is Jim Beaton. I'm a member of the Board of Fisheries and have been for the last 6 years. Greg Cook here is our executive director and also a lawyer for us to handle some of our legal matters along with John Gisberg. Hopefully, for the sake of expediency, keep the applause down there in my presentation here. I guess one of the main thrusts of this is to get into, you know, we've set up we've certainly had the input now for hand trollers and a lot of allegations made, which I restrained myself during that. And we've got the staff to pretty well give the background of some of the biological data. And of course, then it falls down to the true role of the board to make the promulgate the regulations and allocate the catch. And I suppose at this time I'm supposed to justify our actions in previous board meetings, which I feel is fairly easy, frankly, of the time that I spent on the board and stuff. I think that we've put a great deal of time into this particular aspect. Hand trolling, as you well know, covers an awful lot of people. Probably is one of the more numerical fisheries in Alaska. It, as far as the dollar value return, it isn't nearly as dramatic as what the crab fisheries or some of the other salmon fisheries are, but certainly it has a great deal of impact on a lot of people. And I assure you, the board has not taken this particular situation lightly. I don't think the staff really got into that, but they do have a table compiled which shows the amount of hours spent, the amount of presentations, deliberations by the board, and the other principals involved were probably the most all-encompassing of any fishery that we've handled. As far as the getting into the specifics of, say, let's take me as an example. Of course, I only speak for one member of the board. As you know, there's a seven-member board, and the majority carries the day as far as bassling regulations. But I can probably state that for the record that there were probably three specific things that I drew on very heavily, and I think that Mr. Cantillon's presentation pretty well backed me up on giving me the background to make these kind of decisions as far as value judgments on what I use to come up with the present regulation system that we voted on this fall board meeting. First of all, of course, is the status quo. I think it kind of goes without saying that the board has had a tendency throughout the history of the board, all the way from statehood, to take a very hard view of upsetting the status quo. This isn't to be said that it cannot be done, and certainly it has been done. I think Cook Inlet is a dramatic example where the commercial fishermen got the total, for all practical purposes, king salmon catch. And over a course of years, it eventually got down mainly through the efforts of Sam McDowell, where he showed a lot of compelling evidence that he felt the sportsmen were getting short-circuited there, and that they should have more, and they actually ended up becoming the recipients of the king salmon catch up there, where it went from catches of 60,000 to 80,000 kings for the commercial people, it is now down to where they have strictly an incidental catch, no target fishery on kings, and the sportsmen have the Susitna and the and Deep Creek and the rest of these allocated strictly for the sports gear. And this is a typical example of that the status quo can be upset, but it certainly is a it's not taken lightly. It's a very serious thing. In the case of the southeastern troll versus hand troll controversy that's been raging, I hate to limit it to those two things. That's what's been that's what's certainly been elaborated on tonight. But I think that the other user groups, I haven't heard a sportsman testify here tonight, but it's quite obvious with the Juneau Salmon Derby and the Ketchikan Derbies and the Sitka Derbies that if fish do not get to these places where the sportsmen can catch them, that at least their experience, we can give bag limits to 20 to the person. For it really doesn't matter much. Rupe and I have talked about this a great deal. It doesn't matter what kind of bag limit you give somebody if there's no fish there. It's pretty academic anyway. But certainly the sportsman has been a principal player in this thing, and I haven't heard him tonight, but unless some fish get through the inside waters, then he is in trouble. The second thing that I dealt with very heavily, and as far as my own particular vote on these issues, had to do with statistics. And I know I hear a lot of the audience always saying they don't believe this, they don't believe that, and lies, damn lies, statistics, and all this has always been bannered about. But the facts are, they are integral tools that the board has to have to deal with, or any other regulatory body, as well as, I'm sure, the legislature, without using some kind of input from our staff and scientists and other people, statisticians or whatever. I don't know how you would come up with any kind of a semblance of reason about trying to make a value judgment, social, economic, or otherwise. So I have drawn heavily on statistics, and from these statistics, of course, I've come up with these things that I view as somewhat of a reallocation of this particular body of fish. I think David Gentile went through most of the things that I've read over in the course of the data I've got from him. But the one set of statistics that probably the most dramatic comes out of the Icy Straits area, as one of the fellows from Buda there tonight brought up, that area was heavily impacted, and certainly the curtailment on that area of hand trolling brought a very adverse effect on the village of Buda, and leaving the board members had an awfully hard time grappling with that. But I mean, the facts were that if you go from 76 to 77, 78, those were the 3 years that when we first came under the gun as far as scrutiny of this reallocation, statistical reallocation of the catch, you'll see that in 76 they got 19,000, in 77 they got 45,000, in 78 they got 119,000. Now the difference between 19,000 and 119,000 silvers, for example, fish that were destined for these inside waters, for these heavily exploited streams of both Chilkat, Taku, and Stikine, or Chilkat, Taku, and Berners Rivers areas, is very dramatic. And then, the aftermath of that was that we had a very poor escapement, as Dave Cantillon pointed out. Then also the experience for the sportsmen on the derbies. They were at the board meetings, and they were very vocal and loquacious about what they thought would be shortchanged. On the other hand, if you viewed the power troll thing, which they were in direct competition with, you'll see that in 76, 77, 78, it was 52, 50, and 67,000 fish. Or in other words, they maintained pretty much the status quo over that same period of time that the hand trollers went up dramatically. Now, that's not to say that the hand trollers are all bad guys, but I'm saying this is a situation where we were confronted with a bunch of statistics by the Fish and Game staff and what seemed to be a pattern of reallocation to the hand troll fleet. This obviously went up then from I forget what exactly the figure was, but I think percentile-wise it was something like 12% up to 35 or 36%. The board then took this stand that we would like to try to stabilize things. And in the point of fairness, as a matter of fact, I argued for a higher allocation. I think Nick Zalbo, the chairman of the board, wanted to go cut them to 15%. And I said, well, let's strike strike in between here somewhere. And even though it started out at 12% when this dramatic increase occurred, let's come up with, say, 20%. And Gordon Jensen, of course, Peterberg went along with me on this particular issue. And that was what roughly the 80-20 split was derived on. And then, to make things even more complex, I talked to Dave last fall, and he says, yeah, I think maybe the board's going to have to take a hard look at liberalizing this idea a little bit. We've got to fine tune it from year to year, because surely the hand trawlers, with all the restrictions and impediments we put on them, didn't arrive at this kind of a figure. He thought they'd arrived at 10 or 12%. Well, as you well know from the previous testimony of Mr. Cantillon, they ended up with 27%. So, I mean, the point of it is that even though you do restrictive measures, if you have an unlimited number and then they get more efficient and the rest of it, which I think has been conclusively proven, why you have these percentile figures raised. And this is something that we have to grapple with in the board. And I just, you know, which brings up the third thing that we had that we get into, and that was the exploitation rates, which we became very concerned with. When these exploitation rates raise very high, as Dave stated, from 70 to 90% on certain systems, I think almost any biologist would have to agree that they start getting nervous. There's some very subtle things in the history of silvers, of course, as far as how many go out and how many are competing for the habitat area and the rest of it, and there's many ways of interpreting the data. Some people state that if you get 100, they'll produce as much prodigy and go out and do as well as 1,000, but the results are such that if you have more fish competing in a habitat area, then the ones that go out are harder and they come back. There's all types of subtle things like that, but the facts remain that any biologist, I think, would agree with me that after you get over 70% on almost any type of salmon, as far as an exploitation rate, you start getting nervous. And when you start getting up to 90%, nobody's ever proven exactly how many silvers you need as far as having the ideal balance. But certainly after you get up over 90%, it starts to get very questionable whether you aren't arriving at the outer bounds. And we have done that in some of these systems. So that was another factor that certainly made me very concerned. As I previously stated, we already had this reallocation problem where they were growing in leaps and bounds. So we certainly did hone in on them, you might say, a little bit, as well as the power troller. We've knocked 10 days right out of the middle of the power troll season. The reason that we probably haven't, and we have done some things to the gillnetters, and certainly the sportsman is pretty academic what you do to them anyway, because he can't get any bag limits. So he's not really much of a player in this thing. He's not that efficient. I think he's taking something like 1%. So we've essentially honed in on the group that seems to be the principal exploiter of silvers. Certainly, I've stated many times in the past that if you've got a problem on pinks, you look at the satyrs. You've got a problem on sockeyes or dogs, you look at the gillnetters. If you have a problem on kings or silvers, you have to look at the trollers. So we did hone in on the trollers and the hand trollers, trying to get this thing straightened out, not only from the standpoint of reallocation, but also from the standpoint of exploitation rates. So we went ahead with the program that we instituted.
Jim, one thing. Where do the longliners fit in on this?
The longliners don't fit in on this at all. That's strictly a bottom fishery thing on the sorry, Ernie, but they don't have any impact at all on the salmon. They're sticking in the halibut and the bottom fish, so they're not a factor in this. Carrying this on a little further there, of course, we have, everybody's probably well aware that tools of the board are time area and gear type efficiency, and that's about it. That's all we really have. We, of course, don't have budgetary and administrative power and various other things. I know it was stated by some of the members of the public. I think one of the speakers here tonight came up with this thing about, I think he was a little confused about which is quite common, of course. There's so many agencies and everything to get everybody confused. But the board doesn't have the power to determine the very valued judgments such as part-timers and weekend warriors and all these things. And we've been, accused, say, they've come to the board for years and said, well, you shouldn't let these part-timers do this or that. But the board doesn't have the type of power. They do have power to promulgate policies, which we have done. For example, this year we slanted it towards, in a policy statement, towards the rural areas. And we did this basically on a social economic values judgment type thing where we felt that the rural areas probably, just as they did in limited entry in the early days, saying that they probably had more of a dependence, and this is a broad general term, I realize, but we've stated they probably have more of a dependence on the fishery than the urban areas. So we have tried to institute policies that would at least slant it towards the rural areas, and we've done things of that nature, but we don't have, can't go to the limited entry commission, for example, and say, hey, just, knock out all part-timers, we're just going to have the good guys in there, anything like that. So I think that a lot of people miss the point of just how much power the board does have. The board only has mainly those three tools, time, area, and efficiency that they can get into. So we are very aware, and I think the board, frankly, I think the board has a certain amount of compassion for all the user groups in this thing. I know I've never taken any decision. Anytime I raise my hand, I always said that's the one thing I don't like the per diem, but I don't really like to raise my hand. It's one part of the board job that I've never really looked forward to. And certainly when we do have to make these kind of hard decisions, we're well aware that it's impacting somebody. I think that brings up probably one of the last points that I was going to make, and that is that, this thing about whether or not, they're always saying, well, they do this and it hurts somebody. There is no decision the board nor any other the legislature can make that doesn't have some adverse impact on someone. I think that the only thing that we try to do is to try to be fair and equitable and not be accused of being arbitrary and capricious, which I'm sure a lot of the members of the public think we are. But I think that pretty well sets up the stage there, for what you know, essentially what we did as far as the decision-making process is concerned with the board. We, interfacing with the regulatory review committee there, I really don't know how else the board can create any semblance of reason in fishery without making these kind of decisions and have, you know, some adverse effect at least on someone. I know the public is always reiterating to us, not just the hand trollers, but the public in general. We're being sued constantly by everybody from the east side set matters on, along the lines of saying that we didn't make a biological decision, it was political, and on and on and on. Well, if you weren't going to get into it under Title 16 and the rest of it, of course, we're supposed to promulgate the regulations, allocate the catch, and the very thrust of that is that it gets into social economics, which are political type decisions. There's really no way of divorcing those that I can see anyway. And if you were going to do it just strictly on biological data, then you wouldn't need a board. You would just determine the statement and do away with all the institutions and just let people go out at gun clubs or knives and, you know, just make sure you got the statement. That'd be it. I mean, that's really the factual facts of the matter. That's what would happen. And if you were going to just completely get out of this thing about allocation, I've been on the board for 6 years and I've been going to the board meetings for probably 10 years before that. And right down the line, all the way from False Pass on in, you get into these things about, you know, gear types and allocations based on historical participation and other social economic factors. We're battling in your area, George, you know, about the dog salmon going up to that area and whether the False Pass people should be able to intercept any and how many, if so, historically, how many they get, and on and on and on. And this is just something that I think is a part of the function of the board, quite obviously. These things are always controversial, and I guess probably we well recognize that's one of the reasons that we have a board of fisheries is because it's so time-consuming, and plus there's so many political overtones to it, it'd be pretty tough to handle, you know, legislatively and stuff, just from a factual standpoint, and you spend all your time trying to deal with your constituency and stuff. And the board, although it's appointed by the governor, and it's certainly his pleasure, and it's confirmed by the legislature, and it certainly isn't, some people seem to think that the board of fisheries is some kind of sacrosanct bunch of guys that can sit there and never be answerable to their decision, but that's not true. I think some of you sit here and one of our board members turned his sign around and told the legislature that was his name and what were they going to do about it. He lasted about one day. I remember they got him off the next day. So, you know, it's not to be said that the Board of Fisheries people are not responsible to anyone. They have to, their decisions have to be based on sound judgment. I think they have to be based on things that, such as this has been pointed out here by both our staff as well as the public. And I think, you know, in all honesty, that these decisions we've made in relationship to hand trolling, I don't want to hear any hissing from the crowd on this, but I think they've been very liberal towards hand trolling. I just state that. I state that predicated mainly on the data that is before you. You have this set of tables and stuff, and you can see that when we came in, when this particular board obviously started out in about 74, and I think Gordon there is the only one that's been on there for 18 years, but with the exception of that, this particular board that's been making most of these decisions on there, you'll see, came on since 1974, and if you look at the review of the hand troll data, that since that time, the hand trollers have not lost ground as far as the percentile of fishing caught, you know, in the overall allocation scheme. They've gained ground dramatically. They went from 12% or something like that up to the present 27%. Before that, of course, they had 35% last year. So the overall scheme of things, in 75, it was 19%. It went back and forth, fluctuated around, but it's basically up, you know, 27% or so. So to say that the board has been very prejudicial or that they've honed in on hand trollers and they're trying to do away with them as a user group type or whatever, I think is a kind of an unfair statement based on what's happened. They've actually gained ground. We've come into a great deal of criticism from principally power trollers as well as the other user groups, the gill netters and the seiners and certainly the sportsmen. I've had various sportsmen corner me on this and state that we're not being fair to them. We're allowing too many fish to be caught outside. And obviously, this is the one group that dramatically increased. So I certainly think we've been as liberal as we can be with them, at least. And I sympathize with their cause. I think all the fishermen went through that where they've overcapitalized and they've done whatever, and there's young people trying to get in. And certainly, I have three young boys of my own that are about the age of these young fellas here. And I don't want to look anybody in the eye and say, you can't fish or whatever, and I certainly wouldn't want to be on the Limited Interest Commission. It's even tougher, I think, than the job of the board. And, you know, but what can you say? I mean, you have to look for some semblance of reason in order to come up with an orderly management system. And I guess that's about it for me. If you have any questions,
I have one question I'd like to ask. Has the board looked at anything? You know, we get quite concerned reference to escapement so the species of fish will continue. But I'm really concerned about young Alaskans who come from fishing heritage and have a background and they, in fact, want to fish. I would think that the board could arrange some sort of an apprentice based on a residency and age and all that. to encourage this sort of thing, rather than taking young fellows of high school age who, it's a very honorable profession, and just being turned off.
Well, certainly, of course, that isn't one of the board powers under Title 16, but we are concerned of this, and it's, you know, it's overall scheme of things, we certainly are very aware of it, and we have, we do things like pass resolutions and stuff, of course, along this line, and I personally have been involved in a few things over the years on limiting entry and legislation, the rest of it, as far as come up with programs, like in the other fisheries, I think one fellow that testified here tonight before you stated that he got this loan program from the state, and I'd certainly work on this and try to get there. I think that's one of the with the salvations of the whole legislative process, if they could slant things like this, and money slanted towards just Alaskans, you can be prejudicial with state money, in other words, but as you it's pointed out here, they wanted 379 outside licenses and stuff. Now, as I understand, under the handful provision, they probably are not going to have a monetary value, but things such as I use that as an example, I certainly think the board should get into that, and I certainly think all individuals that are concerned about the fishery in the future, the young people getting in it, I think all of us that are in the fishery realize that to not only be a viable fishery and be a healthy fishery, it also be politically acceptable. We have to have some avenue open for young people to get into, or you're just going to, you know, raise all kinds of ruckus about it, and I don't blame them. And I certainly work towards these kind of things, but they're hard decisions, they're hard. It takes an awful lot of very intricate and detailed planning to come up with a system that works, you know, and such as I think your loan program does work. I think it has got a lot of young people from your area in Ketchikan, I know some have got in, certainly from your area in Georgia. In the AYK, even they're just starting to utilize that program, and that it can be interfaced with fishery through the legislature. I think these are the kind of avenues we have to go. But of course, we don't have direct power to come up with a program, only let it in.
But you can make recommendations.
Right.
Mr. Reed. I've always kind of been surprised. I don't know why you were here earlier when I made the statement, it's not no big deal, but when I first came to Alaska 35 years ago, I started out as a hand fuller. I had a 16-foot boat, and then an 18, and then a 30, and then a 32. By the time I got 32, I decided I wasn't temperamentally suited to be a fisherman. But so I'm very sympathetic to the problems with hand fullers. And I, when limited entry came along, I was very concerned. As a matter of fact, the only reason I ever finally ended up voting for it was because I was assured that the nobody was interested in hand fullers. And starting about 2 years ago, and this is something that's always puzzled me, I started making an argument that we should, the proper way to limit hand fullers was to limit the size of the vessel. And I, every time I mentioned this to a hand fuller, I got in trouble, and almost anybody else when I mentioned it to, I got in trouble. But it seemed pretty apparent to me, of course, from years back, you didn't have 40 and 50 foot hand shoulders. There was no such thing. You didn't worry about hand shoulders going offshore. Hell, if a hand shoulder wouldn't go out there and drown himself in a puddle jumper. You know, we had Point Baker boats and this kind of thing, and some people were even still rowing them, but I started with an outboard motor. But it seemed pretty obvious to me pretty early on. Americans, I'm not just American, but human nature is to try to figure out a way to beat the system. And when we came up with limited entry, and all at once these limited entry permits began to be worth a lot of money, obviously if somebody can figure out a way, even though it was just a little less efficient to do it, they weren't going to buy a limited entry permit. Some of them couldn't afford it. It always puzzled me why nobody would ever accept the idea. My idea was that you limit the size of the boat and let them fish when they want to, whoever they want to, and let the size of the boat limit how much competition they could be. But it always puzzled me that I could never sell that idea. Nobody, not even the hand shoulders, wanted it. But it seems to me that had we done that earlier on, we wouldn't, you know, it'd take a lot of talking to convince me that a guy with an 18-foot boat is going to compete with a power troller, and really make it work, or whatever size boat you want. That would be something to determine. I can recognize it's too late to do that now. Something always puzzled me, though. Why would nobody ever buy that idea?
In response there, Senator Freeman, you know, I remember when all of these ideas were first bannered about, and they almost reminded me of certainly they were brought up at the door, and they kind of reminded me of the old Pogo joke about we see the enemy and he's us. And certainly your point's well taken on that. They went beyond that. There were some people that went to board meetings and came up with the idea of going back. No, real hand trollers were hand trollers. They got on the road, as you recall, you know, outboard with an aftermath of that. But the old days, they rode up and down the channels, and of course everybody, I looked up to them because they were really the old tough guys there that got right out and did it. The Norwegians or whatever, they got tired of going around on a helm. But anyway, when these ideas were brought up, and certainly they were brought up, even the board meetings about going, not only, I guess you could legally, we could promulgate regulations, allocate the catch, we could knock efficiency down to where you could only use oars. But believe me, they weren't very popular. I've never believed in saving people from themselves, and I kind of got beat back, I suppose, as much as anybody else did on it, but it was brought up, and there were various people who tried to go the boat route size, but it just didn't get anywhere, quite frankly. And I think that it's only been in the last 2 or 3 years that the thing has really got to the point, you can see from these statistics, where people are really now concerned about it, including the hand pullers, you know, about coming up with some kind of a more semblance of reason. Before that, it was thought, as you stated, I was here in 72 also, and I remember you and Ernie and others, Jordan legislature, and came up with this thing that, well, I guess we were all over remiss in that. We thought, well, they fiddle around out there with a few lines and stuff, and it won't be any big deal. But it did become a big deal. You said how strange how things change, and well, they have changed. So there's no question about that. And those catch statistics are the things that prove the proof of the pudding there. I really didn't know. I never did much hand pulling myself. Did a little trolling back in the mid-60s. I had a time catching with all that power gear, you know. But as far as a hand pulling, I just kind of figured it. They'd go along and get along and it would all work out. But as you can see from these catch statistics, American ingenuity being what it is, they did figure out some way to get a heck of a lot better. They went up 1,000% in many of these areas as far as efficiency. They've gotten out to the point where it is a problem. But it's only been in the last 2 or 3 years that an idea like yours at the boat size would really get a lot of serious consideration, because before that it was just kind of considered that, you know, not much of a problem.
Because if I recall the limited entry arguments, there were one, I don't think very many people in the legislature knew what a real hand puller was, but it wasn't the classification of that licensed sports commercial. Isn't that the way it reads yet?
I defer to Steve.
Well, that's what they call the licensed sports commercial at that particular time.
That was a common term that was started in the late 50s and early 60s.
I'm not going to how it started, but it was the sportsmen that were worrying about that those that were going to be hand pulled for a commercial effort, they were going to be in a different classification. That's really where that originally started. And of course, one thing happened after another. To begin with, what I call hand pullers are people that's their only way of making a living. I'd like to know if there's a figure on those that have other incomes, I mean, besides hand pulling. Now, you know, really who I'm speaking for are people in my constituency. That's the only way they have of making a living. But what we call them, in my, of course I'm a commercial fisherman, we call them the Bayline Fleet, you know, that gets the home shore out here. And on the weekends, and I think that's where you get that big impact of gear, and they have all of these tax credits associated with these, you know, they're really in fat city. But those fellows that In the villages out here in Isaac Straits and Chatham Straits, that's their only way of making a living. And if you're going to put a limit on those guys, what are they going to do next? You know, every politician gets his head tore off for all of the welfare problems. Really, what you're doing is creating it. And I've heard the early testimony tonight where some people that's the only way they make their living. And I think we're going to have some concern for them. Those that have other occupations, you know, and many of those that have this hand pull license are two-income families. I hate to say in Juneau, but that's where a lot of them come. I'd like to know that impact on the gear in the northern areas here that puts those folks in those communities, well, they put them on time limit for fishing. I realize the impact, and some of Mr. Cantillon's figures were very good, I thought, for this early in the game. But I think some consideration has got to be given to those that's their only occupation.
Well, you know, there's no hardcore data there in reference to that.
Well, it's got to be developed as far as this group here is concerned.
But the board did do one thing there. They took and they tried it through the policy statement, you know, as an example of that. They did try to at least do what they could do. They tried to slant it towards the urban areas, thinking that this would, rural areas, thinking that this would get more into the, you know, the real professional type people, is mainly based on testimony we had and some other softer data that we had. It certainly a case in point in Port, or is, the, with Port Alexander down there off the tip there, the island there, where we reopened some areas, the Redfish Bay and around there, trying to get these small areas that were heavily dependent on the fishery and impacted by it, and it, there'd be tremendous economic havoc created by our previous action. We have rescinded some of those things, and frankly, if I could pick up Huna and Elfin Cove in these small areas like this and relocate them somewhere, I would, but they had this real horrendous problem of the bulk of the fish coming through, this is from a management standpoint, huh? But the bulk of the fish coming through this narrow, you know, place called Icy Straits, where they were very vulnerable, and we couldn't seem to get them in the inside waters without this type of a management strategy that we developed. And certainly Gordon was concerned, as I was, from Southeastern, about the fact that we were heavily impacting Huna, and I'm not a very popular person in Huna, I recognize that, as neither is Gordon. And we were trying to figure out any kind of a reasonable program that we could to not hone in on those particular areas. And Elfin Cove, of course, came over and had elaborate testimony at both board meetings, as did Huna, and we tried to get around that problem. We grappled with it. Our policy was that we would plan it towards the rural areas. About the only thing that we managed to do at all that might have brought a little relief off that is when we did give this 10-day closure, we stipulated that like Huna, for example, this is one of the things that following along with our regulatory scheme of things, or our policy statement is, we said that closure would be at the same time that they're eight and six off, that thing, and that this would fall at the same time. So, but these were some of the problems that we were faced with, and some of them are just geographic. Like I say, like Huna, it's in the wrong place to get fish through into the Taku and Sticky and Burners. I mean, it wasn't that we tried to do everything we could. In the case, for example, of Port Alexander, that wasn't really the wrong place, fortunately for it, or say Cake was another example of that. We could then follow through with our policy, but we really got caught in a double bound bind in some of these places like Huna and Elfin Cove.
Mr. Chair.
Sir.
Just one more place.
I don't know what the answer is. I wish I was smart enough, but wouldn't you admit that when a man can, and I'll just dream one up, right? A man can work in Juneau at a $40,000 job and own a 40-foot yacht and have a limited entry, I mean have a hand-soling permit to go out and play with over the weekend, and the young man sitting right behind you can't even get one. Isn't there something wrong with our systems there?
Well, I have no problem with that argument. I've personified that myself for years and said so in hearings and everything else, and certainly there's some people in the crowd that would disagree with you, and I've argued with them about this very issue over the years, and you know, there's all points of view. There are other guys that do it as a part-time thing, and they think they have a perfect right to do that, and I guess that's a democratic process. There are those that feel 180 degrees away from you. I happen not to be one of them. I'd have to agree with you on that. I certainly feel it should be slanted towards it, the full-time, you know, hand pour or whatever, and I've done things that whatever I could to try to slant it in that direction. And, you know, this thing about rural Alaska is one of them, and certainly Port Alexander is a good case in point along those lines.
Well,
did you have any?
I would like to know why there's no hardcore data available to determine who the serious hand throwers are. When every time I make a delivery, they take a fish ticket, and every time about this year, I make out an income tax. Now, why isn't that enough? I mean, why can't you determine through these who the serious fishermen are, the hand throwers?
You're going to get it if I get my way.
I beg your pardon?
You're going to get that information if I get my way.
Well, you get into this.
Hey, you got my income tax. Look at it. That's all I want.
Isn't there a confidentiality clause, though, that you're kind of.
I have nothing to hide.
I know, but I think that under the way we got things set up now, it is tough to dig this out because you have across the board, at least, I know you can't really get your own data anymore the way it's set up. And they have this confidentiality clause, and that's one of the problems you have in the commission. Is that right, Commissioner Simon?
Is that all right if I? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the problems we have is that part of the hand-troll tickets have incidental halibut catches on them, and these have been treated a little bit differently than the others, and we've had to go back and hand-edit about 5 years of fish tickets, and we're still in that process. When we get a good database, then we can go to revenue and have blind IRS revenue income tax statements pulled in a try to catch a cross-section of the hand trollers so that we get some sort of a characteristic of how many hand trollers are dependent on hand trolling for 100% of their income, 50% or whatever it breaks out, get some sort of an idea of of what characterizes, you might say, the hand troller that is substantially economically dependent on this hand trolling for an income, and those that are not. But we haven't reached that stage yet, and this is why we keep calling it soft data. We just we've been working on it for over a year now, and hopefully by this fall we'll be able to have some information that we go out and have some people call town hall meetings with the hand trollers to get some idea of what they think a point system should look like.
Thank you. Any other questions, members of the committee? Thank you.
One last comment I'd like to make is that the board did take a stand, went through a IBM readout thing in conjunction with the last fall's process, previous board meeting, but the one a year before that, and went through a computerized readout, and it's kind of a complex thing, but what it amounted to, it got in the ones that caught the bulk of, and it came up with a figure of 500 that would actually, they feel that a projection would have pretty well taken all this allocation of 2080 type thing, and that's where that figure came from. It was strictly out of an IBM computer. They went ahead there and recommended, and we assumed that those 500 would be allocated to the really hardcore, whatever, hand trollers such as the personified bank there. And that was our recommendation, and we further stated that if we could get it to that number where we felt that, they would, of course, increase in efficiency, but we could handle them and deal as one unit with the power trollers, but that did not come to pass with all the input from the hand trollers and the broad public interest and everything else. It came out to be 2150, I think it was. So now the board is stuck in the dilemma of not really being able in a responsible manner to treat that large a segment of hand trollers and save the power trollers.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Well, I happen to be a saner, but when we're sitting in town, waiting for another opening, and you see all the storekeepers and school teachers and lawyers and insurance agents going out for commercial fishing, it really kind of irritates you. And the gentleman back here that I happen to know is a bona fide hand troller, I think the bigger the population area you get into and their proximity to the fishing ground, you're going to have a lot of those people. And I'm really sympathetic to those that make their living only that way, and to that new generation coming up that has no ability to get into the fishery unless they can buy their way in. And in the beginning, the limited entry law gave that natural resource right to only those that had commercial gear licenses, And I've been a commercial fisherman for about 45 years, And I'm not eligible for one of those. I'm not complaining about it. But a lot of the damage was done in the beginning, and to backtrack, you're going to cause some problems. And if you're going to treat limited entry on a band-aid basis, you're going to create more problems. And then the end result is going to be limited entry going out the window, and then you're going to get back in the same box. So I would say that we'd have to have a pretty conscientious effort to separate that truly those that depend on the fishery for a living exclusively and separate them out. And I don't think that information is hard to get because it's been led to believe. I think the principle of limited entry is correct, but the law is shaped in a way that is creating a lot of problems. And without repeating what I've already said, I think there's got to be a conscientious effort made. I'm not a member of this committee, but I'm sitting here just because I have people in my constituency here.
I certainly concur, and I think I can speak for the board in saying that I think that most of our actions would concur exactly in total with what you're saying there. We're dealing with all of these issues and against all of these input, and we don't have benevolent dictatorship or something in a democratic procedure way, even though you may be sympathetic with what one's saying, many times it's hard to bring that about. I certainly think the board concurs 100% with you as far as trying to slant it towards those people that are the most dependent on
you. Just get this.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fisher.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman. My name is Greg Cook. I'm the executive director for the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game. I sympathize with you sincerely for sitting and listening to a great deal of public testimony. It's the kind of exercise that the board goes through for about 45 days every year. My testimony tonight will describe for you and for the public the extent to which the public has been involved so far in the hand troll regulations that the Board of Fisheries has promulgated. the most important arena in which the public advises the board on salmon issues and troll issues is the regular fall meeting of the Board of Fisheries. At that meeting, the public is given a thorough biological presentation by department biologists. Then the floor is open to public testimony until all who wish to speak have had a chance to state their views before the board. Hand trollers, power trollers, gill netters, purse seiners, sport fishermen, subsistence users, processors, legislators, guides, even lawyers are given a chance to advise the board. Last year, for example, the Board of Fisheries received written testimony from over 200 individuals, organizations, as well as local advisory committees. The board listened to oral testimony on southeastern Alaska alone from 54 Alaskans, lasting for a period of over 16 hours. After the period of oral testimony had been completed, the members of the Board of Fisheries spent an additional 6.5 hours deliberating the issues in southeast Alaska in consultation with representatives from local fish and game advisory committees. The committees represented were Sitka, Juneau, Haines, Skagway, Yakutat, Pelican, and Angoon. Other advisory committees from southeastern Alaska failed to attend the meeting. During those hours of deliberations, the troll fishery in southeastern was once again one of the most difficult areas that the board had before them. To a greater extent than ever before this year, the Board of Fisheries relied on the advice of local fish and game advisory committees in making their decisions. One evening, the board asked the representatives of the local southeastern advisory committees who were still at the meeting to recommend a course of action to pursue in regulating the troll fishery. The Southeastern Advisory Committee spent a long night discussing troll regulations with representatives of gear groups and villages not presently on an advisory committee. Some of the villages who had representatives at the board meeting refused to participate in that evening's discussions because the discussions included talk of limited entry for hand trollers. At any rate, the course of action recommended to the board by the advisory committees was essentially that which the board recently adopted as the Southeastern Alaska Coho and Chinook Management Plan. Those were some of the areas in which the board was advised by the public just this last year. Very briefly, I'd like to summarize some of the most important troll hearings that the Board of Fisheries has conducted throughout southeastern Alaska just prior to this year. These troll hearings were conducted in addition to the regular regulatory sessions that the board holds every year. One special hearing was held in Sitka on March 17, 1979. Over 250 people attended that hearing of the Board of Fisheries, and again, close to 75 people presented oral testimony at that meeting. Another special public hearing of the Board of Fisheries was held on May 17, 1979. Written comment was received for that hearing from over 300 Alaskans. In 1978, the Board of Fisheries conducted a series of 7 special public hearings dealing specifically with the troll fisheries in southeastern. The hearings were held in Ketchikan, Sitka, Petersburg, Wrangell, Angoon, Juneau, and Hoonah. In addition to this extensive public testimony, the board listened to biological presentations detailing the conditions of various stocks of salmon in southeastern that last year alone totaled just over 6 hours. Janet, do you think you could pack those boxes over there up here?
The whole stack?
Yeah, the whole stack. Don't mean to draft slave labor for this kind of thing, but what I have before me right now is a copy, one copy, I didn't make copies for each of you, of the written record of public testimony for the last 3 years dealing only with the southeastern troll fishery. The boxes that I have here on top are filled with cassette tapes. Each cassette tape has 45 minutes of public testimony to a side. It looks like there's about 25 in that box and another dozen or 20 in this box. We've got another 15 or 18 in this box. That's part of the public record. In this box, I'm afraid we have mostly papers, although there are another 4 cassette tapes from the Sitka hearing alone. This written testimony includes some of the staff reports that the members of the Board of Fisheries have had before them to study. Just 1 year's staff reports to get just the last 3 years dealing with the troll fishery was more than I wanted to pack over here, to tell you the truth. Naturally, this doesn't include the overhead projections of data that were presented to the boards. What I'd like to emphasize to you then, gentlemen, is that the Board of Fisheries has had an extremely extensive record from a large number of different users, hand trollers, power trollers, all the various individuals that we've spoken of earlier. The record is voluminous, to say the least. Somewhere back in high school, they taught us about a guy by the name of King Gordius from a place called Phrygia. I can't even tell you where it is, but it sounds cold. Anywhere. King Gordius had what they called a Gordian knot. And there was this oracle who promised Alexander the Great that he'd turn into the ruler of all Asia if he could undo that knot. Well, there are times when resolving the troll issue seems to be somewhat similar to the Gordian knot. I can't promise you everything that the oracle promised Alexander the Great. You may not even end up the rulers of America, much less Asia. But I'd encourage you to look carefully at this record, just as old Alex looked at all the aspects of the Gordian knot, before you make any attempt to cut the knot. Thank you.
Any questions from members of the committee? Thank you.
Just one was, is Greg really an attorney, or was Jim just mad at him when he introduced him?
He passed his bar.
Obviously, if you want copies of this, they're available to your staff, and I'd be happy to put them in Sue's custody, but naturally we try to keep fairly close track of these, so if you'd like to examine the records, it's available.
Thank you. Won't be necessary at this time. Mr. Bodie, sir? Bodie? Bodie? Yes. Sir, would you state your name and who you represent?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is A.W. Buttbody. I'm representing the Territorial Sportsmen, a local conservation group here in Juneau. We have about 600 members at the present time. We've had a long and continuing interest in the matters related to fisheries in this state, and not only in our areas, but throughout the state, because it does affect all of us what happens in other parts of the state. I won't go into all the details on this, but some of you I've had the opportunity of working with for many years. And, I think that the evolution that we've gone through since statehood has been quite an educational process for all of us, and particularly as it relates to fisheries after have been regulated by the federal government for many, many years, and some of their management was good, and some of it was not so good. But anyway, we received that opportunity and that responsibility. And fortunately, we were able to get, I think, what I think, and most people has accepted, probably the first state in the ever union that ever came in with a clear-cut manner in which we were going to manage our fish and wildlife resources. In other words, we fought for a what we thought was had proven itself, a plan that Missouri had adopted many years ago and a lot of other states after going through the pitfalls, and it was some real bad bumps and thumps. And mainly that was a board of fish and game. It wasn't perfect, but it was a good start, believe me, and it has been improved upon. And at this time, gentlemen, I would like to say this to you. I've worked with various boards ever since they were put into conception here in Alaska. And all of them have had made some real contributions to the total effort. And but I think the present board has been outstanding in his efforts, their efforts, and their determination to carry out what I think is the guidelines that were given to them by the legislature. In other words, this resource belongs to the people of Alaska. We want you to manage that in the best interest of all the people. And certainly there's been a very, very definite determination demonstrated by the board to, over the past particular 3 years, I would say, to carry out that full responsibility. Now that means that their number one, in my opinion, is their job is to look at the resources first, follow the resources that we have. And secondly, they have the obligation of allocating those resources in an equitable manner for all of the people. Now, this takes some doing. It is easy to say all of that, but it takes a lot of doing. When you look at the situation that many of you looked at, as I did, when I first came here almost 40 years ago, we had about a handful of people in Juneau that was interested in fishing. And they were fishermen. Primarily all of them were fishing. A few of them was involved in recreational fishing, but most of them were fishermen per se. And their boats were a lot different than what we have now, but some of them were using some of the basic techniques, and those have been improved upon. Otherwise, this community, like many others, had the main thing that supported it was mining. And this is a kind of a historical affair with us. But gradually we've moved out of the fishing arena here in the Juneau area, simply because there just isn't the fish available that there used to be here. And there's, when I first came here, there was about less than 5,000 people. Our census will prove, I think, about 20,000 in the Juneau area at the present time. There was probably, in this total area, some of you can probably correct me if I'm wrong, but in Juneau here, there was probably not over two or three what we would call sports boats or types of that in Juneau. There was two out along the road out of Tea Harbor that I can recall. This lady rented them out. There was other boats that were yacht types that were a lot different from what we have now. We had our halibut boats and our tug boats, and we had all of this type, and we had the trollers and a few seiners, and gill netting was practically something that people thought about, and people did catch fish with nets. Primarily, the other means of taking them was with fish traps, as far as salmon was concerned. And of course, this is gone now, and it's rude, and that's another thing that really threw a challenge at Alaska, is to go from fish traps to a multitude of seiners, other types of gear, and it's all added to pressure. It's all added up on the resource. Gentlemen, I think that we just went a little bit too far. We should have slowed this thing down a good many years ago, in my opinion. But be as it may, we're up against a situation now of rebuilding to some semblance of what our resources were maybe 15 years ago even. And this is going to take some real effort on the part of all of us, and it's going to take some sacrifices on the part of all of us. Now, a recreational fisherman, as you probably recall, in this area throughout southeast Alaska, and there was very little recreational fishing in Cook Inlet at that time. Look at it now, and down on the peninsula, around in all of the areas of Alaska. It's tremendous. This has added additional pressure on the resource. And we have never objected to them being reduced in bag limits or size limits or anything of that nature, so long as it was an interest of the resource and we were getting some reasonable allocation. In this area now, we're down to one king salmon, and our seasons are closed for most of us, in most part, in this area, immediate area. There are a few exceptions, which the board can give you, and the people, the personnel, can outline those for you if you want them. They've got charts of all of that. But we're down to, say, from 15th to June for king salmon in this area, other than beyond Point Louise out and going up Lynn Canal. And we're down to one king salmon, and that's it, period. Now, this is quite a change. We have always said that the recreational sports fishermen should abide by the same rules and regulations, size-wise, as the commercial troller, or the person that was taking king salmon. They should all be put in the same bucket. But we didn't have that for a long time, but that is the case now. And we have, in all of our activities, insisted that during our derbies and anything that we're responsible for, that all of our contestants abide by the same size limits that the commercial fisherman was abiding by. This is only fair. On the coho scene, I was told many, many times by our director of fisheries when we first got into this matter of management, we don't have a problem with coho salmon. Believe me, that was a misstatement if there ever was one, because it's been going downhill, steadily downhill, and it's gotten to the point now, here, we're down, I don't know what our limit will be this year, I don't know whether it's been set, but it has been 5 cohos, and I didn't doubt but what it's going to be cut further. We can live with that, but I just want you to know that everybody is going to have to give something in this thing. There's going to have some expect to be regulated and expect to be controlled. There's no other way out of it. If we're just going to throw the doors open, we might as well forget the Department of Fish and Game and all the money and everything that's going into it and let people go out and just get the last fish. I don't think that's what any of us want. Certainly I know that isn't what the people in the outlying areas want, that do depend primarily still on fish for their good part of their livelihood. I feel that this is one area that the, of course, the legislature has acted on in a number of ways to try to provide for some type of opportunities for the people in the outlying areas, whether it's in southeast or wherever it is, to have an opportunity to harvest enough fish to provide for their immediate family needs. You can call it subsistence, you can call it personal use, or call it whatever you want, and I think this is, it still comes down to a good philosophy, and the state has adopted that, and I think, as you all know, involved in the legislature, the governor has said and many others before, if it comes to the last fish, the subsistent user is going to get it. I hope we don't have to get down to that type of operation, but I do think, and hope that you will think real hard about this whole situation that we have presently with us. We're only discussing one phase of it here tonight. The matter of gear, one type of gear versus another. This is a problem. It's a problem area, but I think it's one that we have a lot of people working on. The Limited Entry Commission, I know, is working hard at this, and I know that the board is working, and being as part of the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, I know we're giving every bit of attention that we possibly can, trying to resolve or assist in some type of a better approach to this, so that particularly those areas that are dependent on, like the inside waters of Alaska, particularly here in Juneau and the areas of where we have just limited numbers of highways where fish are going to come into, and they're going to go into the streams. Those fish have got to be protected. After all means, first, they've got to allow enough of those fish to get in the outside waters into the terminal areas and get into the streams. If there's a surplus, then that's what we should be deciding, who's going to get what and how many of them on an equitable basis. Thank you for your time. Is there any question?
Well, I'm sort of puzzled a little, Mr. Boddy, but I'm sure you said we're doing it right, but I have a little problem. I remember, I probably came here just a few years after you did. That's 35 years ago, but I remember when I first came, everybody could go fishing if they wanted to, if that's what they wanted to do, and you could get in a boat and you could go out and catch king salmon, and however many you could catch was nobody worried about it, and we had fish traps, as you say, and I used to take my little jumping boat and run up and down the lead. I hated those traps with a passion, but, and I know down in my part of the country, I was an early advocate of statehood, and one of the things that was most important to me, more than anything else, was the fact that if we could get statehood, we'd get control of our fisheries, and we'd get rid of those blasted fish traps, and throughout the federal government, manage on fisheries, and we'd do great. Everything would just be lovely. And now, 35 years later, you have to be almost rich to buy a permit to go fishing, and our young people can't even get a license to fish, and we're down to a bag limit of one fish, and you tell me we're making progress, and I hope you're right, but I'm having a hard time.
Well, I think that in essence, I know that we've made mistakes. I don't want to try to put the blame on any one segment. One of the things that I think that, of course, that we, I argued this point with Rick Seaton, Secretary of Interior, which eliminated the fish traps before we had an opportunity to. This has been a hot issue, as you know, and Fred told me, he was here for about 4 or 5 days. I was with him in Fairbanks on a meeting with our delegation from Washington, and I tried to talk him out of that. I said, Fred, let's not get excited about this thing. The people of Alaska are going to make that decision, and they'll probably make it after having a lot more opportunity to evaluate it. But he said, no, I've got to do it now. So we went out, and that's what I meant when I was talking about changing of methods and means. This did throw an awful lump at us all at one time, and in spite of some of the equipment that we got, we wasn't equipped, and we didn't have all the basic information and so forth that we should have had, because there just wasn't any such thing. You might say there was a few research programs, but they were very minor, and they were very local in their nature, and I agree with you. It's taken a terrific bump. We recommended that years ago that they have a coastwide plan of management developed for salmon, period, and this is in 1956. We're just now getting to that point, and believe me, when we're dealing with other nations as we are now, and they're as tough as they can be right now on salmon, and we got Canada involved between us and the rest of the United States, and they're saying we're going to cut off your fish in the Taku River. In fact, they were doing it last year. I don't know how far this will go, and the Stikine, and they're now giving us troubles. I was at a meeting in Toronto last year, and a large delegation from there that was giving us a real bad time about our not allocating enough fish up the Yukon River. They have to have more, and we're hearing from those people right now. They're coming. In the same way with the Columbia River, we've got a real problem. We have a plan, as Mr. Beaton has mentioned, and some of the staff for 1980 on salmon fisheries, but it's being challenged by people in the Washington state area. It's being challenged by others, and we don't know for sure what our plan really is going to be. The Board of Fisheries and the North Pacific Fisheries Council has been trying to develop a unified plan, one that would be reasonable and one that would not create additional duplication and things of that nature. But now we're being challenged, seriously challenged, from Washington, D.C. because of the challenges that they're getting and the pressures they're getting from other areas. And believe me, it's going to be a tough battle. We haven't heard the last of it. I think we shouldn't be fighting amongst ourselves. We're going to have to fight a lot of other people before we get through.
Nothing like a good deer fight.
Well, I've always been in a deer fight.
I
was talking to one of your members about hand trolling, and I can recall on the hand trolling of Hand Trollers Cove out here and over Thunder Bay and around. He can remember a lot more about it too. And down at Wrangell, I had a lot of friends in Wrangell that were hand trollers, and the problems they had were trying to compete with the fast fish traps. And some of them worked at it pretty well. If they happened to know a watchman on a fish trap, they got along pretty well. Otherwise, they had a real rough life of it, believe me. A lot of blisters and very few fish. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Who do we have next? Yes. State your name, where are you from?
I'm Jack Sanderson. I'm from Juneau, Alaska, and I represent myself as a hand troller. I'm going to try to brief and to the point here. And there's just first thing I'd like to mention is the most significant thing that I think quite a few people apparently have just overlooked tonight, and that is Mr. Cantillion came up here and sat in the same chair, and he told us right straight out, he says, quote unquote, our data is weak. Now, I'm an oceanographer, a degree in oceanography, and I've done a few scientific studies myself. The first thing, you know, I wouldn't even attempt to do, and that was to try to regulate people's livelihoods on the basis of weak data. Now, on the return of some 9,000, I think it was 9,000 rivers, there's spawned salmon and Chinook in southeast Alaska. How many stations do we have that actually tabulate escapement?
There's 2,000 fish streams.
2,000.
We have some weird stations. I just estimate probably you get counts, fairly reliable counts, maybe 15 to 20 sites. These are some of the bigger systems.
15 to 20 sites out of about 2,000 possible streams in southeast Alaska that, the idea is that our data is very weak, quote unquote. The director of commercial fisheries said it himself. You know, we don't know how many fish are down there and what our actual effect on them is. That means all these data, all this number that we've been talking about tonight is really almost insignificant and not all that reliable, and we're trying to judge, you know, who gets what fish out of it, you know, or who gets how many fish out of it, and the fact is we don't know exactly very well at all, you know, what the numbers actually are in reality. The second point I'd like to mention, when we were talking about the percentage of catch versus, we talked about percentage of catch of hand trollers versus power trollers. Nowhere in that argument did people mention the number of permits of hand trollers versus power trollers. Mr. Beaton got up here and said he thought he was being very liberal and generous by giving the hand trollers 20% of the catch, when in reality there's 4,000 hand trollers out there versus 1,000 power trollers. And he's being generous by giving us 20% of the catch, 4,000 people versus 1,000 power trollers. Now I just thank him for his generosity. Third point is I like to bring up is a young gentleman who came up here and spoke for the power trollers. I forget his name, he's still here, I do believe. And He commented something about the efficiency of hand trawlers and how it almost is par and equitable with the efficiency of the power and hand troller were almost equitable. And this, that just struck me as plain outright absurd. Anybody who's got a power troll permit and thinks that a hand troller is almost a threat to his income has just got his numbers backwards. I made, well, let's talk numbers. I made $7,000 last year hand trolling. I fished 5 months out of the year, and I fished hard. I fished 10 hours a day, about 6 days a week, 5 or 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. Out of that $7,000, I had to pay for about $1,000 or $2,000 worth of fuel, gear. You know, I mean, there wasn't very much to take home at all, and I'm working at a job right now because I have to, not because I, you know, I'm a weekend warrior. It's because, you know, you can't make it out there just fishing, hand trolling anyway. So the idea that the hand trollers are the power trollers is just totally out of proportion. And the fourth one I'd like to make is the people who endorsed the 20% catch for hand trollers, I think, well, I just certainly wasn't one of them, I guess that's about all I can say. This, I'm really kind of uninformed out of this, all I've been fishing up here for 4 years. 20% for 4,000 hand trawlers as compared to 80% for the 1,000 trawlers is my idea, is just absurd. Majority is majority rules. I think it ought to dearly be more something like 30 or 40% for the hand troll fleet, you know, although that's probably an impracticality in a lot of people's terms. But I'm also wondering, in my final conclusion, is why is it that I ought to direct this one towards the governor if he's the one who appoints the Board of Fisheries, too? If there's 4,000 hand trollers in the fisheries as compared to just a limited number of purse seiners and gill netters and power trollers, how come there isn't a hand troller on the Board of Fisheries? Why does somebody need a $100,000 boat and gear and everything? Don't you think they're going to protect their own industry? I mean, people up there with you know, their $100,000 boat, their $100,000 permit, and those are the people to get on the Board of Fisheries, they're going to protect their own guild. Why isn't there a hand troller on the Board of Fisheries? Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Anderson? Thank you. For the record, please state your name, where you're from, who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Losher. I live in Juneau, Alaska. I worked for Native corporations over the last several years in our region, but this evening I represent myself. Hopefully some of the experience I gained in the region might be helpful to you here today as you deliberate. First of all, I'd like to compliment the committee for holding this kind of hearing, because I feel that since Alaska statehood, and I was around that at that time, very young at the time though, that we've seen the evolution of a regulatory process, the Fish and Game Board and all that it is to be across the state, separation of those two boards. We see the Limited Entry Commission and what it was intended to do and what it didn't do. And then we see the new animal called the North Pacific Fisheries Council, and they're now beginning to have an influence upon Alaska fisheries. And then I would like to point out one more to you, Mr. Chairman, is that there's an unknown. There's called the D2 bill that's going to point out, and we've written letters to the Commissioner Fisheries pointing out to him that federal government is retaining interest in the management of the fisheries if we don't get our act in order in terms of conservation and management, and it's written into the law. So I point out to you an evolutionary process that has changed since the time of statehood and the origination of the laws that we have today. I'd like to also point out that these three or four events or bodies or entities have tangled us into maybe violating civil rights of people, who gets to use the fish, who doesn't. It's tangled us in technology. We don't know where the beginning and the end is. It's tangled us in the social politics. It's gotten us into a new set of economics that we don't know where it's going. And the hand troll hearing tonight is just a symptom of the problem. And I believe that that these boards that we've created, if they go uncontrolled, are not the proper forms with which to manage the resources as mandated under the Constitution of the State of Alaska. The legislature has that responsibility, and I'm proud to be here tonight at a hearing where this is the beginning of your oversight over these entities that have been created and for the management of the resource that belongs to all the people of the state of Alaska. The problem of the hand trawlers is a symptom of the overall fishery. I point out to you, Mr. Chairman, that I resent a commissioner of the Fish and Game Board saying that Huna is in the wrong place or Kate is in the wrong place, because this is the kind of attitude that's evolved out of this process. I'd submit to you, Mr. Chairman, that Huna is in the right place because the Tlingits put it there, because it was the best fishing spot. Then Cake is the best fishing spot. Kloak is the best fishing spot. By God, you know, for politicians and public officials to sit in public and express such a point of view, I'm very concerned. I might point out, Mr. Chairman, that Huna being in the wrong place or the right place is probably the most accurate thing that Mr. Beaton has said in the years that I've known him. Mr. Chairman, there's no saying in Indian Islands are nicest straits today. Fish and Game Board did that. There's no trolling. It's being regulated down to nothing. Our people don't have anywhere to fish in the villages. Our children are disenfranchised and from going into the fishery, and they don't even think of any relief. For instance, I'll give you an example. They closed the fishery, the coho trolling, but they are closing Glacier Bay, they're closing Freshwater Bay, and other areas where our people might fish as an alternative fishery. The Fish and Game Board doesn't consider these kind of things, and so they have a detrimental impact on our communities because of these kinds of arbitrary and capricious policies. I'd like to point out a couple of other things. These regulatory bodies that we've created under the public, in the public interest, have forgotten about the resource. And I agree wholeheartedly with Mr. Cantillon that there is a threat to the fishery and that we should begin looking at conservation methods in order to protect the primary resource base.